Hello, and welcome to the Will to Power Hour, your friendly neighborhood philosophy podcast. Coming to you from the beautiful land of Equestria, I am Joseph Schiff.
I'm Alex Altman.
I'm Jimmy Harrison.
Here at the Will to Power Hour, we spend the first few minutes of each episode reviewing a different craft beer. We then spend the remainder drinking said beer whilst we wax philosophical. Each episode revolves around a particular question or text, and today's topic is unicorns. More specifically, we'll be reviewing Saul Kripke's groundbreaking work, Naming a Necessity, in which he lays out a new theory of reference that incorporates his work on modal logic. One of the consequences of his theory is that fictional objects such as unicorns are not metaphysically possible. In other words, they're never, given that unicorns are fictional object, they never even could have existed in any possible world. And this is actually a pretty counterintuitive conclusion that he comes to. Since, it doesn't seem like there's any logical problem with horse-like creatures with horns existing, but what he says is that those would exist, but they wouldn't be unicorns. And we'll kind of flesh out this argument and what he's talking about and why it's important. We're actually going to begin our discussion, though, first by delving a bit into a phenomenon you may or may not be familiar with called bronyism, and then we'll proceed to discuss Saul Kripke and his book, Naming a Necessity. But first, got to talk about our beer. This was actually suggested by Jimmy, and thank you, Jimmy, for suggesting this particular beer.
Well, I suggested the brewery, not the particular beer, but
You want to tell us a little about the beer, about the brewery and the beer? You know more about the brewery than I do.
well, they're from Sonoma County, Lagunitas, and I grew up in Santa Rosa, which is just a little ways away from Petaluma, where their main brewery is, which is what's printed on the bottle. Although they actually got started in the small town of Lagunitas, which is right next to Petaluma. And they definitely thrive on, they're one of the defining, I think, along with Sierra Nevada, as being, one of the defining sort of West Coast American style beers. In general, I don't mean this one in particular, the little something something ale, which is what we're drinking today. But they've been big on their IPA for a long time. That's been one of their main sellers, and probably what most people know them by is by their IPA.
Yeah, and I actually, we'll pop these open in a second, but this one it's an American pale wheat ale, which I don't know if I've ever had a pale wheat before, but it's kind of what it sounds like. It's a cross between a wheat and a pale. Did we mention the name of the beer? A little
Yeah,
something something.
little something something ale. There have been a couple of variants over the years. They had a limited release of little something extra a little couple years back. I've only been to the brewery once myself, and I can tell you it really smells like hops there. They go big on the hops at Lagunitas in general.
Yeah, no, I mean this one's definitely hoppier than your normal wheat. But all right, well, I guess let's go ahead and pop them open.
Yeah. As it says on the side, life is uncertain, don't sip. So we better go through at least like three of these by the end of the
Oh, I have a whole six pack, so
podcast.
I think my favorite quote about life, do either of you watch It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
Nah, I've seen a few episodes, but not the I haven't really watched
Yeah,
religiously.
same here.
Well, Danny DeVito's character Frank says at one point, I can't remember the exact quote, but it was something like, I don't know how many years I got left, so I'm going to get real weird with it.
Oh, yep.
Nice. And I think that's a good philosophy on life.
You never know, so.
Yeah. So, I'm just looking at the beer. It already looks different than most wheat ales because wheat ales are usually cloudy. This
Right.
one's not cloudy at all. It's pretty clear. It looks more like a pale ale. It's got, a decent head to it, bright white. That's what she said. Definitely got some lacing.
Womp womp.
Definitely got some lacing going on when you like tilt the glass. It's kind of a lighter golden color. So, any comments on the visual aspect?
I'm drinking out of the bottle. I'm not looking
Yeah.
at
Yeah, I'm drinking out of the bottle anyway.
Oh, you guys suck. All right.
I mean it's just like hoppy enough that you're getting like almost that IPA kind of flavor, but it's definitely not overpowering or anything. It It's really drinkable. Let's see. It says it has 64 IBUs. I mean, that's relatively
high.
Pretty
bitter. In case anyone's wondering, IBU is basically a measure of bitterness.
Yeah. And I mean, what's 100 the maximum, right?
I guess. But I mean, IPAs, like the really strong ones, are what, in like the 70s, I think. But at that point, you're already kind of pretty much drowning out any other kind of flavor that may exist in the beer. IBU. IBU stands for International Bittering Units. Not international beer units, international bittering units.
They had to come up with an international standard because they had different ways of measuring bitterness in Europe and America.
Oh, really?
No, I don't know. I just think it's funny that they call it that.
I thought you were serious. Like I would have believed you.
There might have been, but, you know.
We don't know. There was the King's method of measuring bitterness and then the metric method. And they had to come up with a new one to make everyone get along.
So it says here, the International Bittering Unit Scale, or simply IBU scale, is the quantitative value designated to the measurement of bitterness of the beer. The scale is not measured on the perceived bitterness of the beer, but rather the amount of isoalpha acids. So it's an objective measurement of the amount of, I guess, ingredients that cause the perception of bitter taste.
Yeah, and it's 7.5% ABV, so it'll get you a little tipsy.
Just smelling it, it smells like an IPA. It smells like a citrusy IPA, even though again it's a wheat. So it's an interesting beer.
They really like relating the heavy hop flavors at Lagunitas to, I mean, they call it dank, you know, because hops have similar. Organic chemicals, I guess. I think it's pinene is the name of it, that exist in both cannabis and hops. You know, so they have a similar kind of aroma in general when you're around a lot of them.
Yeah.
And that's big, you know, out in Northern California, obviously.
Yeah, I'm so surprised.
I mean, again, it even tastes like an IPA. Well, I'd say it's more towards the pale ale side. It's not quite as bitter, at least not as bitter as some of the IPAs I drink, but it's definitely got some citrus notes to it. It's a strange beer because it sort of tastes like a wheat ale, but I think this much more tastes like a pale ale or an IPA to me. It's very good, but it's not quite what I was expecting.
Oh, yeah, no, a traditionalist, you know, like if you probably gave this to a German beer drinker, they'd probably not be a big fan of it. Or at least if they, you know, you described it as a wheat ale, especially. You know, West Coast beers in general are kind of their own thing. You know, they're just completely crazy on the hops, and that's about what defines them.
Yeah. I mean, do you guys have anything else to note about the beer? I know it's got a really good rating on Beer Advocate. I think it was like 94, something like that. Pretty high.
It's very hard to find in rural North Carolina.
Aren't people really hard to find in rural North Carolina? let's see what's...
Man, that's pretty harsh right there.
I mean, it's remarkable that you can find their beers out there at all, because again, like, they've been around for maybe like 20, 25 years, and they started, you know, just totally small. And I think it was about 10 years ago that they opened a brewery in Chicago, and that's when they started doing nationwide distribution. And some people might know that they got into some contract with Heineken, a distribution contract. And they promised when I went on the tour about maybe a month and a half ago, maybe more like 2 months ago, that, you know, Heineken has no control over how we make our beers. We're not selling out, you know, so they promise to stay pure to their roots.
Well, that's good. Hopefully, you know, hopefully they will stay pure to their roots.
True to their roots, I guess is the phrase. It's getting to me already.
Yeah. So, but yeah, you know, again, good beer. Definitely recommend it. Has some nice pinup girl art on the six pack. All right. Well, shall we proceed? Are we done with reviewing the beer?
I think so.
All right.
Yep. Sounds good to me.
So, you know, when we were coming up with ideas for the podcast episodes, this was one of the things I wanted to do, was review Saul Kripke's Naming a Necessity. And I thought we could do it kind of centered around the unicorn argument. And that got me thinking about bronyism. And my first, you know, initial thought was, to simply heap scorn and derision upon the Bernie community, but then I figured it's probably best to have broader philosophical concerns. So Jimmy looked into some more information about the you know Bernie community, about Bronyism itself, and believe it or not, there's actually some interesting philosophical and literary concepts there, if you want to elaborate.
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, like, yes, in case anyone's unclear, Bronyism is, you know, refers to fans of the new My Little Pony show. I guess there's, I don't know if it's connected, you know, to the My Little Pony that was around when I was a kid, but
it's My Little Pony Magical Kingdom.
Isn't it Friendship is Magic? I think that's what it is.
Or, but, yeah, there's magic in the name. I don't know.
But so bronies are a self-identified, you know, adult male fan base who, as far as I can tell, they the first, you know, coining of the term and sort of, you know, identifying as bronies occurred on 4chan. You know, so it got off to a bad start. Just
so ready in the armpit of the internet.
Well, it's something that, yeah, it's like it leaves for the rest of us. I mean, or at least to me, you know, like I hear that something's from 4chan. It's like, that's got to be bad, you know, but.
And what is 4chan, just in case listeners don't know?
Well, it's like Reddit, except even less, you know, moderated than Reddit. You know, it's just like it's a forum. You know, where people post, and they're completely anonymous too. They don't have to have accounts. Like on, I believe on Reddit, you still have to have some kind of account to comment and have conversations. So there's some sort of like accountability for what you post. Whereas 4chan has always been famous for being 100% completely anonymous. You know, everything just, you know, the servers cycle things out over a certain period of time. You know, messages don't get kept there forever. So. You know, they claim it's nominally, you know, just an innocent thing, you know, and it's just adult guys who are supposedly into My Little Pony. And, you know, on face value, you know, there's, why would there be anything wrong with that?
Let me guess, you're about to tell us something's wrong with it.
Well, I mean, I think, well, just asking you guys, I mean, you guys, does anyone here have like even a neutral conception of bronies, or like,
not really? I disassociate them with furries.
Yeah, exactly.
I have no opinion because I know nothing about them, except that everyone seems to think that they have some strong opinion about them.
So
yeah, I don't know anything about them other than that other people either think there's something wrong with them or don't.
Yeah, see,
that they're unfairly maligned by mainstream media.
That's, you know, definitely a major, you know, thing that a lot of self-identified bronies vocalize. And I should preface this by saying I don't actually know anybody who identifies as a brony. So, I mean, I want, you know, of course, to give the benefit of the doubt. You know, it's just one of those things, you know, where I think our prejudices come in because, you know, it's adult men, you know, that's the problem. Like, it's not that they're male, like, per se. You know, if they were boys, like, you know, nobody would have, I don't think anybody would care if, you know, young boys were.
Some people would.
Well, sure, but, you know, yeah. Conservative, like people who, like, want to steer, you know, their kid down a particular gender role. But, you know, like, no one would suspect anything. But, like, especially given, yeah, that it's rooted on the internet, you know, the fandom, like, their communities are on the internet. And, again, yeah, I think I have the same association as Yoshi. Like, I immediately think of, like, people who are into the whole furry thing, my immediate association is I'm suspicious, you know, like when I hear like an adult male, you know, like over like at least, you know, 25
or 10
or yeah, really, like, I mean, definitely adulthood though, you know, told me that they're really into My Little Pony, I would wonder, you know, what's behind that. I mean,
so,
I'd be suspicious,
you know,
of it.
I even with the furry thing, you know, my impression was always for a while that furries were inherently associated with bizarre kinky sex, but apparently that's actually not even the case. It's just that's like a lot of, I guess, people in the furry community actually really hate the association that people make between being a furry and being into weird kinky sex, because they're not necessarily the same thing. There's a small subset of them that are into that, but that's not necessarily common across the furry community. It is just about the kind of dress up and role play that you find elsewhere. You know, go to any Comic-Con and, you know, see the Star Trek role play.
Cosplaying as animals. Gotcha.
Cosplay as animals.
So yeah, I mean, absolutely. Like in general, as a general matter, both furries and bronies are engaging in a form of escapism. And, you know, whether that's, you know, sexually tinged or whatever, you know, it's obviously going to depend on the individual. And I think it's just that, you know, we've been sort of tainted a bit by, you know, our exposure to the most vivid bad examples. You know, like, I think I remember seeing some bullshit, like, MTV documentary about furries, you know, like, 10 or 15 years ago, where basically it did just show them, like, just having sex nonstop. But, so, like,
you
see
say
that
like it's a bad thing. Come on, man.
I mean, like, it's fine, but it's just, like, I mean, especially when I think the added element with bronyism is that, you know, My Little Pony is something, you know, that is indeed, I mean, I think if you ask the producers of the show who their target demographic is,
and little, it's little girls.
Exactly. Or at least little children at best.
So you're saying it's concerns about pederasty? Is that the...
Well,
that's
what a lot of people look...
ickiness that you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what a lot of people sort of accuse them of, and, you know, they're associated with really heavily. Like, I think even Howard Stern has basically, like, said, like, bronies are basically just pedophiles. You know, which we know, like, on a strictly logical level, that's inappropriate. And the part of the response, too, and to get, like, to more philosophical material, is that bronyism is actually a part of a larger, maybe, cultural thing going on, which some people have called new sincerity, which is they sort of posit that we're moving on from postmodernism, which itself was moving on from modernism. To briefly explain, modernism is just something that more or less began in the mid-19th century, definitely was in full force by the 20th century, where artists, philosophers, intellectuals of all sorts were, you know, responding to the changes of industrialization and the major wars that were occurring as a result of, you know, new weapons technologies. And this idea that the old values of, you know, the pre-industrial era were no longer suitable and needed, and new values needed to be created. I actually think that Nietzsche can be a great example of this, because he talked about just smashing down, you know, old previous values, and we needed to create new ones for the modern era.
See, I thought that was postmodernism, though. My impression was that
postmodernism is saying that, like, even those new ideals are, like, empty and vapid. Like, postmodernism is almost completely cynical, you know, like, and again, the definitions of what is postmodern, there's disagreement, because some people say, like, postmodernism is just a form of modernism.
But so... So modernism, though, contains a lot of this, I guess, emotional and intellectual sincerity, and kind of, because I always thought I always associate modernism with kind of a reflection of Enlightenment ideals and the belief in human advancement and progress, and I associate and maybe this is the wrong conception, and then I associate postmodernism with a reaction to that where we're actually questioning those values themselves and saying, well, those values aren't necessarily really based on anything. Either we're having trouble, you know, having trouble grounding those values, and that was kind of, you know, inherently ironic and cynical.
Right.
Am I not conceiving of modernism and postmodernism correctly?
No, I don't think there is a correct thing, because again, like, modernism refers to, like, a huge array of cultural artistic movements, like, in art, you know, involved surrealism. They associate, like, modernism as being very, it was in full force, like, in the post-World War I era, you know, as a reaction to, you know, how destructive and just brutal it was. I mean, there'd never been a war like that in human history. So that brings us, postmodernism, yeah, there's the sort of bleak cynicism of postmodernism is what led to these people to come up with new sincerity.
Sincerity is sort of the reaction to that. It's sort of
to postmodernism
being less bleak than the postmodern pretenses.
Right.
You know,
right. And there's no, again, because there's so many different terms out there now, like Yossi mentioned postmodernism, and I'm not sure whether new sincerity can be called the same as postmodernism, but in any case, it is defined by trying to like build some kind of new ideals for the world we live in. But it's different from at least modernism, at least the artists that were associated with new sincerity. I read filmmakers like Wes Anderson is considered an example, or Charlie Kaufman.
I can see Wes Anderson. Like if you've seen his movies like Moonrise Kingdom, like they're very bizarre. he's a bizarre guy, but yeah, there's like this kind of optimistic. Innocence. Yeah, it's a return to innocence. Yeah, it's a return to childlike innocence and a childlike wonder about the world.
Well, it still very much incorporates, though, I think, the bleakness, because I mean there are a lot of, since we'll just go with the Wes Anderson example, since a lot of people have seen his movies.
What movies has he done?
He's done Moonrise Kingdom,
The Life Aquatic,
The Royal Tenenbaums.
What's the one with Jason Schwartzman?
Grandma's Boy?
No.
That was not a Wes Anderson film, but
he did Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that one. That was one of his better, probably his best recent one.
Yeah, Alex, if you're not familiar with these movies, I think you would like them. They're bizarre, but like interesting and thought provoking. But they're all kind of reflective of this childlike innocence that, you know, a return to a childlike innocence in the arts. You know, an optimistic outlook, a respect for emotional sincerity.
Yeah, they have.
Okay.
They have pretty, though, dark emotional content, though, still. There's, like, pretty grim things that happen in the films.
But it's ultimately optimistic.
Right. It's trying to, like, you know, because that's why I think is the common thread I saw between some of the artists I mentioned. Because one I would point out in music that I thought of are the Flaming Lips, if you've ever listened much to their, like, lyrics.
I mean,
like,
I've heard them. I haven't really... Well, listen to them per se, but I know of them and I've heard them.
Like, everyone's heard, like, Do You Realize, the song that was in a bunch of commercials, you know, it's like, it starts, do you realize that everyone you know someday will die? You know, like, that's how the lyrics go. And it's like, but instead of saying all of your goodbyes, you know, it acknowledges the bleakness, but like tries to find some way out, you know? And I think that's in some ways what defines new sincerity, and that's what I think some people have used to include bronyism into.
So what I'm trying to figure out is, in what way does new sincerity differ from the old sincerity of, you know, down-home guys just kind of telling it like it is?
Well, I think they're
and just, you know,
I think maybe
old boys and apple pie and all that good shit.
Well, my
like how is it different from old sincerity? Is it just a return to it, or is it something more nuanced?
Well, I think it's just, again, an arbitrary name, really, but...
No, but, like, yeah, I mean, the thing that it identifies, is
sure,
it a new phenomenon, or something that's just a return to the old ways of doing things?
Well, that's what I was trying to elucidate about the Wes Anderson and, you know, the Flaming Lips examples. Like, there's the acknowledgement, at least from a rational perspective, like the meaningless, like the objective meaninglessness of, you know, the world we live in. Like, there's no, we don't have, like, you know, overarching faith in some objective order anymore. Like, everybody kind of knows, you know, like, there's this general dysphoria.
Very Nietzschean
of, like,
of you.
Well, no, I mean, that's what I think Nietzsche's point was, is just like at a certain point in history, you know, like once we start learning things, you know, there's no going back. You know, it's like the knowledge, you know, kills your innocence. And so I think, you know, we're a very jaded society. And so new sincerity is like, is acknowledging all those things that make us jaded, like about how just all those old values, all those myths, the things that used to give us hope, don't really give us hope anymore. And it's like, it's leaving us feeling, you know, existentially very empty. And so, you know, people reach to, you know, new things to find some way to just feel this sincere joy, you know, and that's, I guess, how Bronyism has been conceived intellectually. Although, I have to say, I mean, I doubt that anyone who's actually participating, who identifies as Brony, you know, would necessarily, you know, be thinking about all this, you know?
Yeah. Like, see, I think it seems a little bit overly in-depth.
Exactly. Like, that's why I think it's hard. Like, I see what the people who would make that argument are getting at, that, you know, it's just, like, Bronyism is an attempt to a return to innocence, you know? But, you know, the thing is, you know, I doubt the creators of the show are thinking about that, for one thing.
They're thinking about, you know, how to make a good kids show that'll bring in, you know, lots of money.
Exactly. And so that's why I think it's a little strange to suggest that they have some kind of real intellectual designs, you know, behind My Little Pony. I mean, it's, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if you want to be a brony, don't be creepy. You know, like, don't bother little girls at conventions.
So if you could distill your philosophy of life into one sentence, it would be, don't be creepy?
That's important. I don't want to leave it at that.
All right. Well, I think we've definitely thoroughly exhausted Bronyism, with our knowledge of it, at least. Could have had a Brony on, I guess.
Yeah. No, it is unfortunate. I would like to see if there's somebody who really looks at this a little more in depth.
We'd have to use, like, a voice changer to keep their identity secret.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you said earlier that you don't know any Bronies. Maybe it's just you don't know anyone who's going to come out and identify as a Brony.
Well, I mean, I have exposure. There's a baseball blog that I go on all the time that, like, one of the most frequent posters, is, you know, a diehard Brony, and he posts, like, gigantic My Little Pony gifs, like, all the time, and it's...
Is he doing it ironically?
Well, like, I mean, he does it, like, you know, when it's a San Francisco Giants blog, and, like, when they win a game, he'll post, like, a gif of, like, the ponies, like, celebrating and stuff, and it's like, okay.
So you call it a gif?
Like, yeah. No, I know the whole thing about gif and gif.
I call it a gif, and... Yeah. Well, actually, yeah, we probably shouldn't even begin that debate here, because that could get pretty nasty.
Jif is the peanut butter, Jeff. Yeah, my only exposure to a Brony's, like, is this poster on the blog, and he, you know, for all, all I can tell, you know, he's just having fun with it. It doesn't seem to be, like, sexual, you know, so it's like, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt in general. You know, like, it's a little strong, I think, to presume you know, any malintent on their part.
Yeah. All right. Well, I vote that we leave the topic of Bronyism at this point.
Hear, hear.
All right. So moving on to Kripke. Before we actually talk about naming necessity, I just want to really briefly get two concepts out of the way and explain them real quick, because they're pretty integral to what the book is about. The first concept is a concept of possible worlds. All right. So when philosophers talk about possible worlds, they're not talking about the same thing that physicists talk about when they talk about things like multiple universes. When philosophers talk about possible worlds, they're talking about, they're using them as a way of analyzing what are called modal statements or counterfactual statements. Statements about, like, pretty much anything that contains a subjunctive tense. So anytime you say, if things had happened this way, then this would have happened. So anytime you're using the word if or could, you're talking about things differently than the way they actually are. So, you know, if Alex had, you know, a different childhood, perhaps he would have been a porn star or something like that.
It's not too
late.
It's not too late.
You only suspect that that's a counterfactual. I mean, you
that's
have
true.
No evidence.
I don't know. What would be your porn name? Your pen name, stage name. What is it like? The street you grew up on and your first pet or some shit like that.
I don't know. I think they just make up a name.
No, I wouldn't go by that rule at all. I've thought about this. I'd be Jimmy O.
Jimmy O.
No, I'm just kidding.
All right. So anyway, yes. Statements like that, statements like things could have turned out differently than they are. Anytime you're imagining counterfactual situations like that, for a number of reasons, you can't use classical logic to analyze those statements. You just can't. And that led to the development of what are called modal operators. We're not really going to get into, you know, the technical aspects of how modal logic works, but just suffice it to say that when you talk about counterfactual statements, you can't use classical logic to analyze them. You have to use modal logic. Okay, and one way to conceive of these counterfactual situations is by thinking of possible worlds. So a possible world would just be something like, you know, if I talked about Alex being a porn star, like, what else would have had to have been the case for that to happen? All of those facts together comprise a possible world, and possible worlds are very useful tools to think about counterfactual situations. So I just want to, you know, we're not going to really explore that, you know, the details of that concept itself too much, but just when we say, when we say something like, there's a possible world in which Alex is a porn star, we just mean there's a counterfactual situation in which this could have happened, and here are all the facts that go along with it. That's all you gotta, that's really, that's just the basic idea. The second concept that we're going to talk about is theories of reference. So that's pretty much just what it sounds like. When I say a name, when I say Alex or when I say Jimmy, I'm referring to those two people. When you delve into how language works, it actually gets pretty weird and uncertain as to the mechanism by which those terms refer. And it's actually created a lot of problems for figuring out precisely how language works and precisely how logic works. And what Saul Kripke did in his book, Naming a Necessity, that we're going to talk about, is he actually said that these two concepts, possible worlds and theories of reference, actually go hand in hand. And we need to rethink our theories of reference in terms of possible worlds. All right. So that's just basically what's going on. Again, we're going to flesh this more out in detail, and eventually it'll lead to the weird kind of conclusion that objects like unicorns couldn't exist. So, quick background on Kripke. Hold on, I got a burp, I think.
Anticipation is killing me.
Okay, sorry, we're drinking beer. So, all right. Kripke, he is easily the most important living philosopher and logician, and easily one of the all-time giants. I mean, he really is up there with people like Kant and Descartes and Bertrand Russell. He's a currently living philosopher. He was born November 13th, 1940. He's 75 years old. He was born in Bayshore, New York, but he grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. He's a devout Jew. He comes from a very religious Jewish family. Child prodigy. Taught himself ancient Hebrew by the age of 6. Read the complete works of Shakespeare by the age of 9. And mastered calculus by the end of elementary school. And completely changed the face of philosophy when he was in high school. And yet his mother is still eternally disappointed in him. What? You don't call? You don't write?
Sorry. Great Jewish mom impression.
Yeah. I can say it. I'm Jewish. Alex can say it too. He's Jewish. Jimmy, that's racist. So when he was in high school, this was actually his big foray into philosophy. He developed what's called a completeness theorem for modal semantics. I don't actually really know what that is. I sort of have an idea. We're not going to really talk about it. You just need to know that he did something really big, he's a genius, and it was his first major contribution to philosophy, and his work on modal logic that kind of came out of that had a really big impact, interestingly enough, on computer science. There's actually this funny story that's kind of like a legend about Kripke, that the Harvard math department, when he published this paper, he was like 16 at the time, that they wrote him a letter asking him to come work there, and his response was, "My mother said that I should finish high school and go to college first." So again, I mean, this guy truly is a genius. I mean, he's brilliant. He earned a bachelor's degree in mathematics from Harvard. He never got an advanced degree after that. What's a professor going to teach him? He could go figure it out on his own, really. He ended up, while he was an undergrad, actually, he taught classes at MIT, just down the street from Harvard. And he went on to professorships at Rockefeller University and Princeton University, where he taught philosophy, logic, math, and computer science, I believe. He was awarded the Rolf Schock Prize in Logic and Philosophy, which is the philosophy equivalent of the Nobel, in 2001, and he was appointed Distinguished Professor of Philosophy and Computer Science at CUNY, which is the City University of New York, in 2003, and he is currently retired. He's known for never actually writing anything. This is the kind of funny thing about Kripke. All of his major contributions to philosophy, of which there are many, they're almost all just these kind of off the cuff extemporaneous lectures that he gives that are then later transcribed by other people. And he'll like go through and edit them. And actually, Naming a Necessity is one of those. It was a set of three lectures given at Princeton in 1970. He's just an amazing off-the-cuff speaker. I think one of his students who ended up being a major figure in philosophy, I think Michael Devitt, I think was his name, said that it's Kripke's brain, you know, the way his mind worked was just amazing. I think the quote was, it's as if he had privileged access to reality. So
quite a compliment.
Anyone having privileged access to reality, definitely, yeah, it's a huge compliment. And actually, you know, the funny thing is when you actually go back through and read his lectures, so this actually goes kind of hand in hand with why he doesn't actually write himself. When he goes back through his lectures, he'll edit them, and then he'll put these really long rambling, well, not really rambling, but he'll put these really long footnotes in there. And some of these literally go on for two or three pages. So it's like you're reading two or three pages of 9-point font footnotes explaining a point, but the whole time he's just equivocating and saying like, "Oh, well, I haven't really fully fleshed out this idea."
Only putting it in a footnote because it's not really that important. But I'm just going to ramble on for like
an hour about it. Not necessarily not that important, but like, "Oh, well, someone may disagree with this point, but I wasn't really making a detailed argument. I'll just leave it up to someone else or myself in the future to finish this art." He equivocates a lot. And that might have to do with why he doesn't write, you know. He might just be afraid of being wrong. I don't know. But again, he really is just
arrogance. He doesn't like being sort of called out on his arguments.
Yeah.
So he makes sure they're, you know, very equivocal.
Well, I mean, his arguments are still out there, obviously, one form or another, but I think...
Well, but he likes to equivocate that he can always hide behind, I was just preparing this, you know, based on a lecture and, you know, without notes, and so, you know, I can't be blamed if there are certain gaps in the evidence.
Well, I think that's kind of fair because, I don't know, I mean, I think it's kind of silly when, you know, philosophers, like, publish some kind of treatise that, you know, purports to be, you know, like, "Oh, this is the be all end all of like math and logic. I've got it figured out." You know?
Yeah, I think we're basically talking about two extremes. But, you know, it's just kind of funny that he just doesn't really like to commit, it seems like. He's afraid of commitment.
Although he is married. Do people even like, does like the world of philosophy like care about like these, you know, definitive published works as much as they did back in like the 19th century?
I don't know, but they definitely make fun of Kripke for it. We're not the only ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, he really is a giant in philosophy and logic. But one of the works, the work that we're going to be talking about, is called Naming a Necessity. And actually the title, Naming a Necessity, I think is a throwback to a book published by Rudolf Carnap years earlier. I think it was called Meaning a Necessity. And I think Kripke was kind of referencing that with the title of the work. And it's, as I mentioned before, it's a series of three lectures given at Princeton in January of 1970. And it was published in book form with an addendum that kind of addressed and expanded on a few points in 1980. This book absolutely rocked the foundations and changed the course of analytic philosophy. He completely dismantled our notions of how possibility, necessity, and reference work. And one of the interesting things that he did, this may or may not come up, is he, prior to Kripke, and this was a big thing with Kant, was that, I'm going to use some technical terms here and I'll briefly explain them. The a priori was always associated with the necessary, and the a posteriori was always associated with the contingent or possible. All right. Briefly, just that just means that any truth that is anything that is necessarily true prior to Kripke, it was always thought that those were a priori truths. And a priori truths are just things you can figure out by rationality alone. You don't have to actually look at the world. So 2 plus 2 equals 4.
Right.
Would be an example of something that is a priori true and is also necessarily true. It's just it's true just based on how logic works. And then the a posteriori, those were truths that you get from experience. So things like, you know, an apple, if you let it go, it'll always fall to the earth. That's going to be true.
Well, you don't necessarily know it will always fall.
Well, but it's a contingent fact about the world. It just has to do with how physical laws ended up working. Physical laws could have been different.
It's like an empirical fact.
It's an empirical fact. And he was saying that empirical... So the thought prior to Kripke was that empirical facts are only possibly true. They could have been otherwise. Whereas logical facts, a priori facts, are necessarily true in all, you know, to use that possible worlds language, in all possible worlds. You can't think of a counterfactual situation in which 2 plus 2 equals 5. You just can't. And through some clever thought experiments, Kripke completely upended centuries of philosophical wisdom by showing that there are, in fact, merely contingent or possible a priori truths, as well as necessary a posteriori truths. So that's kind of one of the big things he did. But then he also, and this is, you know, what we're going to be focusing on, is he developed this new theory of reference. And just the short of it, and we'll flesh this out more in detail, is that he was saying that the reigning theory of the time, which was descriptivism, that theory of reference is problematic because of how possible worlds and reference work together, and that we need to rethink naming and return to a million-like paradigm, and I'll explain what that is. But one of the interesting things is that one of the consequences of this new paradigm is that fictional objects, such as unicorns or even Sherlock Holmes, are not metaphysically possible. There's no possible world in which they could have existed, which is actually pretty damn counterintuitive. It doesn't seem inherently illogical or problematic that unicorns could have existed. They're just horses with horns. And what he's saying is that under his theory of reference, horses with horns could have existed, but they would never be properly called unicorns. So that's just kind of the short and dirty of it. Sorry, gotta drink my beer here. So to begin with, to just jump right into it, way back in the time of John Stuart Mill, whom we spoke about on our last episode, he was a philosopher, public intellectual alive back in the 1800s. His theory of naming is kind of actually what most people, if you just ask a person on the street what they thought about how names refer, it's probably something pretty close to what they would say. He said that the meaning of a name is simply the thing to which it refers. So when I say Jimmy, the meaning of the word Jimmy simply is Jimmy himself. What do you mean, meh?
I said me.
Oh, I thought you said me. Okay. I thought you were disagreeing.
No.
But And I mean, it seems intuitive, you know, names refer, so yeah, sure, why not? The meaning of the name is just the thing to which it refers. But it ends up creating, and that was the paradigm during the time of Mill, but then a lot of people kind of subsequently pointed out problems with that way of looking at things. And it creates problems for sentences like, and this is a description that Kripke gives in Naming a Necessity. So Kripke uses the description of, or uses the example of Hesperus and Phosphorus. So when he says Hesperus and Phosphorus, those, I guess, are old words used by, like, the Greeks or some shit
right.
for the planet Venus. So when he says Hesperus and Phosphorus, he's just talking about the planet Venus. They're just different words for the planet Venus.
Yeah, it's how they looked, how Venus looked, because they thought it was a star, you know.
Well, yeah.
And they called it the brightest star in the morning for Phosphorus and the brightest star in the evening for Hesperus.
Yeah, so the morning star and the evening star. So the evening star is Hesperus, the morning star is Phosphorus, and,
right.
you know, we can continue to say star, and when we say star, we just mean celestial object.
We're always talking about Venus.
When we say Hesperus or Phosphorus, we're always talking about Venus, but it's important to keep in mind Hesperus is what you see in the evening, Phosphorus is what you see in the morning. And so Millianism creates problems for sentences like, and I quote, "It was a scientific discovery that Hesperus is Phosphorus." So for a while, people thought that they were two different objects. It wasn't until, I guess, people did a number of, you know, they looked at them for a while and did a bunch of calculations that they figured out, oh, this is actually just the same object. The thing we thought were actually two different things are really just the one thing. So our intuition would tell us that a sentence like, "It was a scientific discovery that Hesperus is Phosphorus," our intuitions would tell us that a sentence like that is true. And when we say scientific, we mean we got it just by looking, by examining the world. It was an empirical discovery.
Yeah.
But the problem with Millianism is that if the meaning of a name simply is the thing to which it refers, it just is its referent, then that sentence is false. It wouldn't have been a scientific discovery. It would have just been a logically necessary fact. You know, of course, Venus is Venus. That wasn't a scientific discovery. That's just a logical It's logically necessary that A equals A.
It's treating, you know, it's just saying that Hesperus and Phosphorus are referring to the rock itself, like, and they don't have meaning beyond that, right?
Right. Some people kind of pointed out problems like that. So descriptivists like, and we'll, you know, probably get into these two philosophers more in later episodes, but Gottlieb Frege and Bertrand Russell. Gottlieb Frege was, I believe, a German philosopher, primarily working in the 1800s and I think early 1900s. And then Bertrand Russell came a little bit later. He was like also late 1800s, but he didn't die until like 1970, so he was kind of working largely in the 20th century. They were both logicians and mathematicians, and they claimed to solve these problems with a new theory that names are, to use Russell's terminology, disguised definite descriptions. So when I say the word Hesperus, what I really mean, the name Hesperus is simply a disguised definite description, and the description is something like the brightest star in the evening sky, or maybe a number of other descriptions that come along with the brightest star in the evening sky. So for the case we just mentioned, where we say it was a scientific discovery that Hesperus is Phosphorus, that retains our intuitions about that sentence being true. Because what we're really saying, according to Russell, is that it was a scientific discovery that the brightest star in the evening sky is also the brightest star in the morning sky. And again, star just means celestial object for all intents and purposes. So it retains our intuitions, right? So descriptivism has a lot of advantages over Millianism. And actually, another one of the areas in which descriptivism is helpful is when we talk about the problem of negative existentials. In other words, referring to objects that don't exist. So like Santa Claus. For example, when I say that Santa Claus doesn't exist, well, when I'm saying, you know, a thing doesn't exist, I seem to be referring to a thing, but under Millianism, if the meaning of a name is its referent, and you have an empty referent, then there is no meaning to the name, and so the sentence doesn't even make sense. But clearly the sentence, Santa Claus doesn't exist, makes sense. That's another problem with Millianism that descriptivism solved, because descriptivism is, essentially, it would be saying something along the lines of, this collection of properties is not instantiated in the world. And there's nothing wrong with saying that. Alex, I don't know how much you studied that kind of thing in college, but is that a pretty good description of what's going on? Is that a good description of descriptivism?
It seems to be, from what I can tell.
Your description of descriptivism was full of
descriptive.
Yeah.
Was descriptive. Yeah. In its descriptive capacity.
Move on to Kripke's stuff, like for the problem more with the fictional characters and things like that.
Okay, so those are kind of, you know, so Millianism said that the meaning of a name just is its reference. Descriptivism said no, it's this guy's definite description. We solve a bunch of problems by thinking about it that way. But then Kripke comes along and fucks up everyone's shit. And he says that we got to think about descriptive, we have to think about names in terms of how they work in counterfactual situations. Okay, so think about the example of Hesperus and Phosphorus. It seems, remember, Hesperus is what was referred to as appearing in the evening sky. So it's the brightest object in the evening sky. Well, it seems like we can think of another situation in which Hesperus was not, in fact, the brightest star in the evening sky, but the second brightest star. That seems perfectly possible. Perhaps there was another celestial object out there that was just brighter than Hesperus. There's nothing problematic or illogical about thinking that. But Kripke said that, okay, if that were the case, then descriptivism runs into a problem. Because remember, under descriptivism, the meaning of Hesperus simply is the brightest star in the evening sky. So if we had a situation in which it turned out not to be, we'd be saying that Hesperus is not the brightest star in the evening sky. Well, that would actually just translate under descriptivism into the brightest star in the evening sky is not the brightest star in the evening sky. Well, that's a contradiction in terms. That doesn't make any sense. You might be motivated to say something along the lines of, oh, well, okay, it's just the second brightest star now. Well, okay, if it were the second brightest star, then you'd still be saying something that's completely uninformative. You would just be saying the second brightest star in the evening sky isn't the brightest star in the evening sky. So that doesn't work either. That's just analytically true. Clearly, the sentence itself is informative. So when you think about counterfactual situations, it shows that descriptivism has to be false, because objects, the description of an object simply is a contingent, for the most part, they seem to be contingent properties. They seem to be properties about the object that could be different. And that doesn't seem to be how names work, because when I name an object and I talk about counterfactual situations, I'm talking about the fact that the descriptions could have been different.
Well, I just don't want to get ahead of ourselves, like, because I'm still thinking of all the fictional character examples, like, just to flesh that out more.
Yeah, we'll talk about the fiction stuff later, but so essentially what the old theories of naming left out was a really important feature of names. Names are what Kripke, and this is to use Kripkean terminology here, names are rigid designators. They rigidly designate the same object in possible worlds. They track objects across possible worlds. So, you know, the name Richard Nixon is one that he uses in his book. It tracks the same person in all possible worlds, but, you know, if you were to just say, oh, Richard Nixon just means the president of the United States back in 1960, whatever, 1970, well, you run into a problem because, well, Richard Nixon may not have been the president. There's a perfectly logical counterfactual situation in which he wasn't. So the name Richard Nixon can't just mean the president of the United States. It has to be tracking an object. It can't be tracking features of an object, because those features can change. And that was Kripke's big insight here. It was to tie the notions of possible worlds in with notions of reference. So he comes up with, he uses this to develop his, I guess, positive theory of how names work. He says that when we look at an object, so plant, take you know, Venus, or actually, I think even more relevant, have you guys heard about the potential planet X that's, like, out, like, well, way beyond Pluto?
Now they're calling it Planet 9.
Are they calling it Planet 9?
Yeah, because Pluto's no longer a planet, you know?
Oh, yeah, I guess it makes sense.
And Planet X, yeah, Roman numeral.
But, like, essentially, from my understanding, what happened is that, like, months ago, or maybe within the last, like, year or two, I don't know exactly the timeline, but very, very recently, some astronomers were looking at some objects out in the Kuiper Belt, which is, like, the collection of, like, asteroids and other material that encircles the solar system. And they noticed that some of the orbits were not acting as predicted, and they think that currently there may be an object out there, and it's looking more and more likely that it's actually a single planet. But and this, again, this is kind of getting back to how Kripke's theory of naming works. So right now all we have is a description of an object's effects on the orbits of other Kuiper Belt objects that we know exist, but we can't actually see the thing. So what we're doing, and this is the way Kripke thinks that names and descriptions work, he says that a description can initially be used to fix a reference. So in this case, the description being something like, oh, the thing that has these gravitational properties that are affecting these orbits, we're using that to fix our description on an object, the object that does all of those things. Once we actually catch a glimpse of that object, or, you know, perhaps even just develop an incontrovertible proof of its existence, because from my understanding, we haven't actually proven that that object is out there. We just know something's affecting the orbits. Once we either conclusively prove it or actually see the object, and we call it, hey, that's Planet X, or hey, that's Planet 9, once we do that, we've, to use Kripke's terms, we've baptized it. And then that baptism, that you know, naming of it, you know, Planet 9 or Planet X, whatever, will travel throughout a community of speakers. It'll kind of cement its place in our language. And that will forever fix the referent of the name. And after that, the description itself about how it affects the orbits, that becomes dispensable, because we could think of a possible world in which it didn't have those properties, but we're still referring to that object.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because, well, especially with something like, yeah, the Planet 9, Planet X, like, I mean, we don't even know it exists. And, like, again, I think I'm leading a bit onto the unicorn thing, but it, you know, it has to do with the, you know, the number of factors that go into its description. Its description as it stands right now is much too vague to possibly, like, definitively say, without having saw it first, what exactly Planet 9 is.
Right, but we still seem to be able to refer to it with the description, oh, it's, well, people affecting these orbits, right?
Exactly. So, yeah, no, that brings into question, what are we really referring to when we say Planet 9 or Planet X? You know, it's, you know, we're just pointing something totally theoretical.
Right, and I guess what I'm kind of getting at with this is, once we figure out what it is, assume it is a planet.
Right.
The description, that stuff about how it affects those orbits, remember, under the descriptivist theory, however it affects those, whatever that description is, that's just what the name means.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to point out is that, no, that can't be what the name means, because once we figure out what the object is, it seems perfectly possible that whatever hunk of rock it is out there may not have had those particular properties. It may not have affected those orbits in that particular way. It may have been a little bit bigger, may have been a little bit smaller and had a different gravitational field, but the object itself may have had different properties. So descriptivism has to be false. But then traditional Millianism can't be true either.
So we know good examples of rigid designators are probably our names. Like, we know, sure. Like, I know you're Yossi without having any description of you.
You don't, like, know that's, me.
Like, you know.
Don't act like you know me,
I identify, you know, people. Like, I don't. When I think of, like, if somebody asks, like, who is Yossi, who is, like, I don't, like, think of some, you know, description, that's for sure. You know,
right,
or, like,
right.
It's just, like, from pure, like, from the day I met you, like, it's like, and you introduce yourself as Yossi, it's like, it clicks in my head, oh, that's Yossi. And that's just from then on out, like, you are always, they're the one and only Yossi, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I know there's other people.
You're the one and only Jimmy in my heart, too.
Exactly. But that's, so the, I guess that's what I'm getting lost at, because, you know, I think maybe a problem we're running into is, like, and maybe it'll get fleshed out in the unicorn thing, but it's like, but like, why don't I need any description? Like, I don't need to know, like, your DNA to know who you are.
No, but you can, the idea is just that, no, Kripke was just, again, remember, we had millionism, which said that the meaning of a name just is a
Okay, yeah.
And then descriptivism comes along and says, well, millionism has problems with sentences like, it was a scientific discovery that Hesperus is phosphorus.
Right, but...
So a name is really, well, hold on, so a name is really just a disguised definite description. And then Kripke comes along and says, well, descriptivism really has problems too, because it can't handle counterfactual situations in which a description is, in which an object can actually have a different description than what is actually the case. And so he kind of argues for a return to a million-like paradigm.
Okay. Let's go to the unicorns. Let's go to the unicorns, actually. I think
okay, so... The way this kind of all culminates in the argument that there can be no unicorns, there are actually kind of two related arguments. So, Kripke says that natural kind terms, so terms that describe things like species, like, you know, tiger would be a species, or buffalo, and also other so-called natural kind terms like gold, things that describe kinds rather than individuals. He's saying that he says that those terms actually act a lot like names, and he kind of goes through these same examples of, you know, he kind of went through all these examples of tearing down descriptivism by thinking of counterfactual situations in which names, in which the individuals associated with a name can have different descriptions. He does the same kind of thing for natural kind terms. So he talks about tigers. Like, you know, a tiger is like this quadrupedal feline animal that's tawny yellow with stripes or whatever the dictionary definition is.
Well, lots of we could tigers.
Think. Yeah, and so, but we can think of like, okay, well, maybe a tiger doesn't have stripes because it's albino, or maybe it's not tawny yellow because it's albino, or maybe we could think of a situation which perhaps tigers only have three legs rather than four, or whatever. He kind of goes through this, you know, description of, like, counterfactual situations in which they have different properties than the ones actually ascribed to them in the dictionary definition. And he says that, you know, using these similar examples, it seems like natural kind terms act just like names. They rigidly designate, for instance, the term tiger rigidly designates tigers in all possible worlds. It designates the species itself, the thing. Rather than a description. And what he says about unicorns is that the problem with unicorns is that, you know, with tigers, we have like a DNA structure, we have an origin, but with unicorns, all we have is an outward appearance. Essentially, horse-like creatures with horns. He says you can imagine a number of possible worlds in which there are all these different horse-like creatures with horns that have radically different DNA, have radically different internal structures, and have radically different origins than each other, but they all look pretty similar or the same. Well, which one's the unicorn? Which one are we talking about when we say the unicorn? There is no fact of the matter. That's the so-called metaphysical thesis. When we say unicorn, we have to be referring to one of them, but we don't know which one we're referring to. None of them is really rightfully called the unicorn. But then there's another, and part of this kind of goes back to the fact that unicorns were never baptized. Remember, unicorns, this is all assuming that unicorns are fictional, they were made-up creatures. There's nothing that was actually baptized, and I think that's part of the problem. And then the other part of the problem is just that, you know, this description is incomplete. But then he actually goes on to say that even if we, you know, some archaeologists found fossils of unicorn-like creatures, or even an actual creature itself that was a horse with a horn, unicorn—they would only be rightfully called unicorns if the myth was about those creatures. In other words, if the person transcribed, or if the person writing the myth about unicorns was actually talking about those creatures themselves. So, under Kripke's theory, if we're assuming that unicorns are fictional, then there can't be unicorns, because essentially he seems to be saying that the stories underspecify the description associated with unicorns. But then my issue is like, but what if we could describe essential properties of unicorns? Could we then rigidly designate them, and wouldn't those creatures be rightfully called unicorns?
So if we could give the exact genome and the skeletal structure and describe them in excruciating detail.
Whatever the essential properties of a species are, what would happen if we could describe those? Because Kripke thinks there are essential properties. He talks about that. He thinks there exist essential properties. Wouldn't those be enough to rigidly designate unicorns?
Well, it would have to be enough properties information given for whatever whatever defines a species in the first place. You know, like, because every species has its defining characteristics at some level. Like, why, you know, a lion is not a tiger. Even though they're probably part of the same family still. Because that, like, yeah, it goes into the issues of taxonomy in biology, actually, which, again, I don't want to go on that tangent. But
yeah, I think Kripke would agree that if you could specify it down to the essential features, you could. But I think his point is that the original myth did not do that with unicorns, and therefore there can't be unicorns in any possible world, because we don't have any essential features to identify.
That's the thing. I guess that's my question, is he harps on, I mean, he talks at great length about the problems with descriptivism, and he never once says anything along the lines of, oh, but if they only described essential properties,
yeah, cause
missing something?
When he's talking in the like-kind example here, you know, because the categorization of that kind is it's at the species level, you know, whereas I'm sure he would say, like, you know, things like the group kind mammals is, you know, a definitive, a rigid designator too, right? Because there are essential properties to being a mammal. And,
well, but it's not, I think Kripke would say it's not, I don't think he would say it's rigidly designated because mammals have certain properties. He would say, oh, no, it's rigidly designated because those things are mammals. You're pointing to the same object in all possible worlds.
The thing is, like, mammals are described, they're defined as, you know, anything
that's
that
the
gives
thing.
Birth
that's my
to
question.
Live young.
He's saying that natural kind terms like mammals or species terms, those act just like names for him.
Mm-hmm.
They are not fixed in all possible worlds by description. That's my question. It seems like if we could, I mean, couldn't we just rigidly designate unicorns by coming up with inventing just these essential descriptions?
Well, I mean, he would say that mammals are fixed in all possible worlds, right?
Right.
Okay.
Because we're referring to the thing, mammals.
But,
you know,
it's so hard, though.
But that's the question. What is the thing, though? That's the thing,
like,
with,
how,
like,
species
terms.
How do you get away from its definition? Yeah.
Well, yeah, with species terms, there seems to be something different about species terms. We're not referring to individuals. What are we referring to when we say a species?
Yeah.
You know, are we referring to the set of all tigers? Well, it doesn't seem like we're doing that, because, well, there are tigers that aren't yet born. I mean, like, what is a species? Is it, there seems to be something different about species than individuals.
Right. I mean, and I think there's no, because those words, like, nothing was, nobody, like, pointed at an object and said, that's a mammal. They said, we have all these animals that we have to figure out some way to classify them. All right. All animals that give birth to live young, we'll call mammals. You know, so, like, the
honestly, I'm not sure that mammal even is a rigid designator.
But
I
would
think
Kripke
would say that it is. It's a natural kind term.
Yeah, like,
but
it's a description. In any
it's not a name.
But
well, that's the question, though. That's the thing. That's the thing. Kripke is saying that
tiger is used as a name, though.
Well, we're saying, like, anything. It's a rigid designator because in any possible world, an animal that gives birth to live young would be a mammal.
I think Kripke, I think he would say that mammals, like the term tiger, does rigidly designate. But I think for us, this potentially, in reality, actually creates a problem for Kripke, because it seems like when we use the term mammal, it seems like we're not necessarily referring to a thing in the same way we are when we use the name of an individual, or depending on your view, perhaps even a species term like tiger. It seems to create a problem because we might really just be referring to a description.
Well, yeah, because I think that he gets into trouble just because he uses the word species, you know, because the word species itself, like, it has a very specific taxonomic definition, you know, in biology of, like, what makes something a unitary species versus another. Like, even if they're very, very, very close, you know, and there are some species that, you know, are, you know, there's, you know, I don't know, hundreds of thousands on Earth. So, you know, like, I think he got himself into trouble by using, like, because the classification for this like kind that he's using isn't like a word itself that has a definition, you know, that was determined for scientific purposes.
Right. So I guess one of the questions would be like, okay, well, can we think of a world in which tigers themselves only had three legs? Well, maybe. Could we think of a world in which tigers themselves had all the properties we associate with elephants? Well, no, then I think, and this is what Kripke is saying, well, no, then we'd be talking about elephants. We wouldn't be talking about tigers anymore. So the description, in terms of species, like, descriptions can't rigidly designate. That's what he's saying. But then, like, and then, like, moving up to mammals, like, okay, could we imagine a possible world in which mammals don't give birth to live young? I don't know. I mean, can we? Would we be talking about something other than mammals? I don't know.
Well, it makes it seem like, well, I mean, of course, we can.
Fundamental question.
Well, and of course we can call anything, we can name anything we wanted to in reality.
But are we referring to the same thing?
Exactly.
And what is the thing? And that's the question. Can we give it by essential properties? If we can give it by essential properties, then Kripke is wrong. So are the traditional descriptivists. But more importantly, Kripke is wrong.
Well, obviously, yeah. We want to make sure Kripke's wrong.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it's, I definitely understand what he's trying to get at, too, and the problems with, you know, mythological things that, because I also thought, outside of the species example, I remember reading a couple times that he mentioned, like, Sherlock Holmes as an example.
Yeah, so, like, Sherlock Holmes, it's the same problem with unicorns. There's, like, underspecification. So you could have, like, multiple individuals that fit that description. None of them is rightly the Sherlock Holmes. But again, I would go back to, what if we gave essential properties? What if we described in like, precise detail all the essential properties that make an individual, and called that, whatever instantiates those properties, Sherlock Holmes? And wouldn't that rigidly designate Sherlock Holmes?
Well, I would doubt it in that case. See, like, I actually...
But if it's essential properties, they hold in all possible worlds,
right,
for that individual.
Well, the question, though, because it's better, I like it better with an individual, you know, or at least I see Kripke's issues, because, you know, they're, like, coming up with essential properties of an individual is, I think, extremely challenging. Like, if I were to come up the essential properties of you, Yossi, that would be impossible. You know, like,
you cannot define me.
I mean, even if I had your DNA, that would not be enough, you know, to define Sherlock Holmes. Because Sherlock Holmes, humans, you know, besides their DNA, you know, are also the sum of their experiences throughout your life. So, I mean, maybe...
Well, because if you're hyper-specifying that he be exactly like Yossi, right, in life experiences, DNA, origin, everything, then Yossi only exists in this possible world, right? And the whole idea that it rigidly designates
same
person in every possible world is kind of a...
Well, I think what Jimmy's talking about... I don't think Jimmy's talking about so much hyper-specificity as he is essential property. What are the bare minimum essentials?
Right.
Is that correct?
Well, like, I would, like, if I were in a completely different possible world, like, I would know this Yossi when I saw him, like, and talked to him. I mean, I mean, there are other possible worlds where everything could have happened up to this point the exact same way, but it just things differentiate from now. So up to this point, everything I know about Yossi, I know this Yossi. So if I saw this Yossi somewhere else, I would call him Yossi, you know?
I think Kripke would say that even if Yossi had different life experiences and looked somewhat different than he does in this actual world, he would still be Yossi. And I think that's the trouble with the whole essential properties, you know, grouped together can just describe him across all possible worlds.
Well, I was thinking, back to that Richard Nixon thing, because it's like Richard Nixon is always, you're always referring to Richard Nixon.
Right, but you're not always referring to someone who, you know, raises his two hands up in a little peace sign and says, "I'm not a crook."
Which,
you're all, you know,
right.
That could be different, and his life experiences could be very different. But you're always referring to Nixon.
That's all I meant.
In the same way, you know. So my point is that Kripke would say that you can't just use a description, no matter how detailed, to rigidly designate someone across, you know, every possible world, and that the same is true of species. So Kripke is saying that even if you have a perfectly detailed description, you still can't use that as a rigid designator because it doesn't.
No, I agree. I think Kripke is saying that, but I guess what are the essential properties of Richard Nixon? I think Kripke.
It's hard to suggest that.
Right, and he suggests that, okay, well, maybe something like having the same lineage, so having the same parents might be an essential property. So could we just say any well, that wouldn't be alone enough to define. That's the question. I guess one of the questions might even be, are there essential properties of anything? Are we trying to specify? Like, I tend to be a Wittgensteinian when it comes to language, in the sense that, and we might explore Wittgenstein on a later episode, but Wittgenstein thought that a lot of philosophical problems, especially ones like these where we're examining language, he thought a lot of these problems arose because we're taking language out of its natural context. So we're trying to examine how words work outside of their actual use.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And so it might just be like when we talk about essential properties, we sort of have an idea of what that might mean, but then when we try to examine what essential properties actually are, we come up empty-handed. We can't find any. They sort of slip through our fingers. And so maybe essential properties don't even really... Maybe there really aren't any essential properties.
It's definitely... I mean, fascinating. I would love to talk more about Wittgenstein because I did get a little taste of him in undergrad. I did read his Blue and Brown books.
Oh, his manuscripts.
Yeah,
is that right?
Well, just like
his,
Kripke's.
His notes.
Well, they were transcribed by his students.
Oh,
same as Kripke.
Because he didn't want to commit.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Kripke. Oh, Saul. All right.
Good stuff, guys.
I think we've exhausted unicorns and Kripke. Next time on the World of Power Hour, we'll be sort of continuing our discussion on possible worlds, not so much theories of reference, but on possible worlds, and we'll be discussing David Lewis's theory of modal realism, in which... Alex can, damn it, I fucked this up. I'm drunk.
Basically,
we'll be discussing David Lewis's.
It's awesome, and I'm going to tell
we'll
you
be discussing. We'll be discussing David Lewis's theory of modal realism, in which he thinks that when we talk about possible worlds, we're really talking about real, physically existing worlds.
Not abstract.
Not abstract counterfactual constructions, but real, physically existing worlds. So worlds in which Alex really is a porn star, or worlds in which his counterpart, not Alex himself, it couldn't have been Alex himself, but worlds in which his counterpart were real physically existing objects. And we'll be getting drunk while we do it, like we are now.
Yeah, we picked a good one today. the beer.
Yeah.
It's only 2:30 here. God damn it.
You're welcome.
I gotta figure out some way to.
It's 5:30 somewhere, buddy. Yeah. Well, 5:21 anyway.
I was gonna do some yard work.
You can still do yard work.
Oh so yeah, that, I should totally use heavy machinery while driving.
That's the only way to use heavy machinery.
You'll be like wearing a cast in the next podcast. You'll be like, Jimmy, what happened? Well, you know about last time, there was a little incident.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I wanted tragic gardening accident.
Yeah, you guys will know what happened if you don't hear from me.